All right, today is Tuesday, October 1st. We're going to start back on page 69. That is going to be wrapping up chapter 6 information with some bone info. You know, on Thursday, we actually did a little bit of this information on hormones, but I want to go back and repeat. Let's just start from the beginning here and talk through these hormones once more. All right, so very top of your page, there are three hormone blanks to fill in. The first one there is parathyroid hormone. We call it PTH for short. Cool thing about this hormone name is it tells you where it's made, and it's made in a set of parathyroid glands that are found right around your thyroid gland. So the thyroid gland sits like a butterfly-shaped gland. It sits right around your trachea. And if we were to remove it and look at the back side of it, there'd be 4 to 6 nodules of tissue. Those pieces of tissue make parathyroid hormone. This is on 69. So what does parathyroid hormone help regulate in our bloodstream? Calcium, good. And is the response of parathyroid hormone to increase your blood calcium or decrease your blood calcium?
Increase,
right. It helps to increase your blood calcium. And the way it does this is it activates bone-destroying cells. Those cells will break down the matrix of your bone tissue, and that releases the calcium into the bloodstream. So what is the name of those bone-destroying cells?
Osteoclast,
good. So when we were talking on Thursday of last week, I mentioned that if your body needs calcium for muscle contraction or nerve impulse transmission, you can't wait for a milk craving to hit. You can't wait for 3 or 4 hours later to have something that's got calcium in it in order to give your body the calcium it needs. Because you need calcium immediately when you've got to have it for muscle contractions, we have to store it in our bones, and that's why this hormone is so important. So this particular hormone is probably more important for adults than its antagonist. The antagonist to this hormone is actually number 2. It's called calcitonin. What does it mean to be an antagonist? It's against, yeah. So if the job of PTH is to raise blood calcium levels and calcitonin works against that, what does calcitonin do to blood calcium levels? Decreases it, right. So what kind of bone-forming cells are going to work in response to calcitonin? Osteoblast, right. And going back to our picture here, where is calcitonin made? Thyroid, good, made by that thyroid gland. All right, so interesting that those two hormones that regulate blood calcium sit right next to each other in two adjacent glands. All right, so which population of cells do you think is more active in young kids who are growing their bodies? Osteoblast or osteoclast?
Blast,
right. Yeah, so, you know, once we reach adulthood, they think that calcitonin is less responsible for bone growth. They think it's more of a case of, calcitriol, vitamin D3, and then PTH actually raising blood calcium levels. They actually think that calcitonin's job is done once you reach adulthood, and it may in fact be. All right, we did not get to cover this growth hormone on Thursday of last week, so let's take a moment and talk about that one. Number 3's blank is growth hormone, or GH for short. You may sometimes see it abbreviated as HGH. What does that little H tell us? Human, right. There's a gland in your brain that sits in the cella turcica of your skull bones, and that little gland releases growth hormone. The anterior pituitary, this front piece of the gland there, is the one that specifically makes and releases that growth hormone into your bloodstream. And the cool thing about growth hormone is it tells you exactly what its job is. It makes you grow. So if you think back to the cell cycle, there were time periods in there that we called growth 1 or G1, and growth 2 or G2. Sometimes they're called gap 1 and gap 2, but the G could just as well mean growth periods. Well, that's when growth hormone is active in most of our body cells, telling them to basically just grow. So where you see the biggest change in your body size, well, that's skeletal muscles. you also see your bones grow in length in response to growth hormone. And oddly enough, your liver grows in response to growth hormone. So those are the places where you dramatically see growth hormone causing a change in your body. So as the name implies, growth hormone makes your body's cells grow. So as you can imagine, there can be problems with growth hormone, and that's what we're going to talk about next. Under number three, you'll notice three bullet points. First of all, what does the term hypersecretion mean?
Above,
too much. So it's too much growth hormone. What do you think would happen to a body if you had too much growth hormone? You'd get really big, right? So perhaps really tall, really large in size. What happens to your body if you think you have too little growth hormone? You're small, you're short, right. And so the lack of or underproduction of growth hormone would be hyposecretion. So there's those hyper-hypo prefixes coming back again for us. So let's talk about hypersecretion. If you're a child and you have excess growth hormone, then your epiphyseal plates are actively dividing. What does that mean can happen to your growth? If your epiphyseal plates are actively dividing, yeah, you've got growth that can occur lengthwise, right? So those bones just keep elongating and elongating. And like I mentioned, growth hormone affects most cells of your bodies, but we most dramatically see it in your muscles, your bones, and your liver. So this person on the left here has what we call gigantism. Sometimes it's just called giantism. And the case of this starts in childhood. It may persist into adulthood, and we may see people reach heights of 7 feet plus, 8 feet, even 9 feet. Throughout history, there have been cases recorded where people were 12 feet, even 14 feet tall. So you might think that, you know, somebody who's got gigantism is just bigger and stronger than the average human being. But in fact, if you take muscles and bones and you stretch them longer and longer, they're not strong. What are they? Thin and weak. Yeah, so it's just like taking a rubber band and pulling it and pulling it. You know, it's not going to have the strength to support the body. You know, people with gigantism may be 450 pounds or heavier. And if you put that on a thin stretch skeleton, they just don't have the support to put up that kind of weight for the body. This man here in the 1930s was actually a very unusual case of gigantism. He was born in 1922, he died in 1940, and at 18 years old, he had not yet gone through puberty. That's kind of odd, right? Most people, by the time they reach 18, have at least started into puberty and probably finished puberty. But you can see he was 8 foot 11 and still growing. And the really weird thing here is, by having not gone through puberty, his epiphyseal plates were still dividing, and that zone of ossification was just trekking right behind. So had he lived, he would have continued to have had epiphyseal plates dividing and the bone growth occurring right behind it. It would have kept making his bones grow longer and longer. So, you know, your mom has probably told you, don't pop the blister, right? Okay, well, unfortunately, he had to wear leg braces because of his big body size. The blister popped. He got full-blown body-wide sepsis, or infection. And 2 weeks later after this, he was dead. He had been touring with the circus at this time, so he was well-known as the Alton Giant. And when they buried him, they put him in a 9-foot concrete vault. Yeah, so they were scared that somebody would dig him up and then use his body after he was dead. So interesting case there, had he continued to live to see, you know, what had happened to his body size. Back in this time period, around late 1930s, 1940, they may not have known what to do to stop this condition. Nowadays, we know how to give hormones to slow growth. We know that testosterone for a male would cause puberty to onset, and that also would help to stop the bone growth. So that is his dad there with him. Yeah. So if you've been to Myrtle Beach any time in the past and gone down to Main Myrtle, you've seen the wax museum on the street. They've got it like closed off by glass. That's him in the little wax museum out there by the street. You don't have to pay to see him. He's just standing out there. Some of our most recent tall people have not pushed 9 feet. Some of our most recent giants have been somewhere in the 8 foot range. This man, you'll notice, looks like he's carrying a cane. That's because, again, gigantism causes a lot of stress on the joints. It doesn't allow for the body to grow and accommodate for, you know, like a rib cage that can support heart and lungs, that can, you know, deliver enough oxygen to the cells and tissues. This guy was a basketball player about 10 years ago, and he retired with, guess what, joint problems. So, you know, not uncommon for people with gigantism to have that issue. Most of our women who have gigantism cap out on the upper 7 foot range. This woman died in her 40s. It just puts so much stress on the body, the heart, the lungs, the joints, that it makes it very difficult for them to get around. So you might have noticed that some of these people, like this guy here, you can kind of see his face. You can see this woman's face. The face looks really large, and that may be a secondary issue that's going on. You'll notice on your worksheet, hypersecretion of growth hormone in an adult is actually a different condition. It's called acromegaly. Okay, so acro as a prefix means extremities. What does mega mean?
Large.
Large, yeah. So what's happened for these people is, for instance, this lady here, she probably had gigantism as a child. She grew to somewhere in the 7 foot range. Maybe she passed through puberty and the estrogen and sex hormones closed her epiphyseal plates. What does that mean happened to her lengthening process? It stopped. So maybe she still had excess growth hormone for whatever reason. It could have been genetic. It could have been a brain tumor in that pituitary gland. But for whatever reason, she continued making too much growth hormone. Is that called hyposecretion or hypersecretion?
Hyper.
So maybe she was 25 years old, and then instead of growing taller, her bones started growing wider. Is that called endochondral ossification or appositional?
Endochondral.
Appositional. Yes, so endochondral makes your bones lengthen. Appositional makes your bones widen. So you're not going to notice if your humerus gets bigger. There's a lot of muscle tissue there. But you would notice if your fingers get wider, and you'd certainly notice if your facial bones get bigger. So that's why some of these people look like they have different faces compared to somebody who doesn't have it, like Yao Ming. Notice his face looks, he just looks like a tall guy, right? But if you look at this lady or even this man, their facial features look exaggerated. They look larger than the normal person's. So that's because of acromegaly. And so you're not going to have acromegaly as a kid. This would only onset after the epiphyseal plates close and endochondral ossification is done for. Around what age do we end lengthening of the bones? About 21, yes. So late teenage, early 20s, we're done with endochondral ossification. The only growth that can occur after that is appositional, meaning bones grow wider. Yep. And so you can have appositional throughout your lifetime. This is excess appositional growth.
Appositional is wide and endo
is long.
Okay.
Yep. So you can thank endochondral ossification for the height that you are today. And then appositional growth occurs throughout your entire lifetime. So enlargement of the extremities includes hands, feet, facial features that change over, you know, the mid-20s and beyond. This guy here looks like maybe a teenager in the picture on the left, totally different looking in the picture on the right. This is not the kind of thing where somebody wakes up and says, you know, I think I've got acromegaly. Somebody may notice pictures of you have looked different. Somebody may notice things like sleep apnea have evolved. And I'm not saying that anybody and everybody with sleep apnea has, you know, acromegaly. But when the bones change back in the facial area, we do see things like sleep apnea develop. So this would be something that develops over a course of years where they're seeing excess growth hormone. You may have heard of this guy, Andre the Giant. He not only had gigantism, but he also had acromegaly. That's why he had a large head. Hands and feet also would have been enlarged more so than an average person. Well, on the other end of the spectrum, we have what's called pituitary dwarfism. And I just want to mention that dwarfism comes in many different sizes and shapes, but this particular kind of dwarfism is a lack of growth hormone. So what gland makes and releases growth hormone? Pituitary, yeah. So when we talk about growth hormone deficiencies in kids, we specifically would say pituitary dwarfism because we mean it's a lack or a hyposecretion of growth hormone. Would pituitary dwarfism develop in an adult? You can't shrink, right? Okay, so once you've reached adulthood, you know, you've escaped all possibility of pituitary dwarfism having any effect. Why must this condition affect only kids?
Because they must stop growing.
Yeah, they're the ones that are actively dividing with those epiphyseal plates. You're right. On the far left here, you'll notice a dwarfed person. That's actually a thyroid disorder. We'll talk about it in just a moment. It's called congenital hypothyroidism. An old name for it is cretinism. And it's just simply hyposecretion of thyroid hormone in kids. The two we're talking about right now are these two. These two have pituitary dwarfism. And you'll notice they look like children. Their body proportions are normal, what you'd expect to see in terms of torso ratio to leg length. But notice their bodies are differently shaped than the two next to them. These two people have adult-sized torsos. Their arms and legs are shortened. That is a different kind of dwarfism called achondroplasia. And if you've ever seen Little People, Big World on TLC, that's the form of dwarfism that they have. It's a growth plate disorder. Growth hormone is not the problem with their bodies. And then, of course, for comparison on the far right, it's a normally sized person. So people with dwarfism are typically under 4'7". The reasons can be many. There's actually over 100 different types of dwarfism. But specifically, when we talk about pituitary dwarfs, what hormone is being hyposecreted? Growth hormone, right.
And which ones?
It's these two that look like children. Their body proportions are in ratio like they're supposed to be. People with other forms of dwarfism may have a normal-sized torso and shortened legs, like these two here. All right, so let's talk about calcitriol. That's our next one on the sheet. This is just fancy wording for vitamin D3. Okay, so we've talked about vitamin D3 before. So part of the process of making vitamin D3 or calcitriol starts with sunlight exposure. Your kidneys and liver actually finish the process of making this particular hormone. So you've got to have the sunlight exposure in order for this hormone to be properly created. You can also get this hormone in your foods that you eat that are calcium rich, milk and ice cream. Things like cheeses are a good source of vitamin D3 as well. Later in life, some people don't have enough calcitriol to make their bones strong and healthy, so they may take a supplement of vitamin D3. And we've actually found that there's a link between vitamin D3 and heart health. So, you know, you can imagine that there's far-reaching effects to having a healthy heart or having a heart that's not so healthy. So interesting that sunlight exposure drives bone health, muscle health, like heart tissue. So, you know, it's a good reason not to stay cooped up inside all day, every day. In people who do not have enough vitamin D3 or calcitriol, they can end up with a bone softening disorder called osteomalacia. Okay, and so that question there, what is the cause of osteomalacia? The cause is either a vitamin D deficiency or a metabolism problem. And the age group that's affected is adults. The next question says, how are bones affected? Well, they become soft. They fracture under the body's weight. So sun exposure can help with vitamin D. We know that, of course, supplements can help with vitamin D. But left untreated, this condition can cause bones to just basically bend and fracture under your weight. So this is not osteoporosis. It's a very similar condition. But this particular condition has to do with the calcitriol issue. The result is the same, though. People with osteoporosis and osteomalacia both can lose height. They both can have bone fractures, but the causes are different. This particular condition is due to lack of enough calcitriol, which may simply be a lack of sun exposure or having not enough vitamin D in the diet, or it just could be a metabolism disorder. Okay, so this is an adult issue.
So people that are bowlegged have osteomalacia?
They do not have osteomalacia. They have rickets, which is the next condition. But you on the right track. All right, anybody need the slide? Okay. All right, well, you got it brought up a very good point. Now, the difference between osteomalacia and rickets is age. So it's the same condition. It's a vitamin D deficiency or metabolism disorder, but rickets is a kid's disease. Same condition here. The problem is the bones become soft without enough vitamin D. They can bow under the body's weight. They can fracture. Interesting condition here. You know, if it's caught early enough and we can treat it, then we can produce normal bone growth in people who have this disorder. But sometimes, you know, the bones have a metabolism issue and maybe they're unable to respond to calcitriol. And in that case, all the vitamin D in the world's just not going to make the bones grow. So it's critical, though, that this condition is caught while kids are growing. Once they reach adulthood, then this condition is not going to be something that we can help with or fix. So you're right, bow-leggedness is one thing that we associate with rickets. I do want to mention that, you know, bow-leggedness may be other reasons, but oftentimes because the body's bones are weak and soft, they may bow under the weight, like you see here, varying degrees of it. And even here, these are, you know, just malformed bones that are going to bow and just not be able to support the body's weight. Okay, so let's recap. With calcitriol, if you have a deficiency as a kid, that condition is called what?
Rickets.
As an adult, the condition is?
Osteomalacia.
And similarly, we just talked about another issue with hormones. If you have a pituitary deficiency of growth hormone as a kid, what condition does that cause?
Dwarfism.
But if you happen to have too much as a child, you have what?
Gigantism.
As an adult, if you have too much growth hormone, your condition is now called?
Acromegaly.
Good. So it's just keeping straight whether or not you've got a child or an adult and which hormone we're dealing with here. Do y'all have questions so far? Okay. So you'll learn in Bio 211 that thyroid hormone, or its most common component, thyroxine, is important for metabolism. This is the one that makes you feel like you can get out of bed in the morning. If you don't have enough thyroxine, you'll know it because your metabolism is what makes you feel like you've got the machinery to run, you know, during that day. There is actually another issue associated with thyroxine. It makes your tissues develop during childhood, and I'm really trying hard to avoid the word growth, because when I say growth during childhood, your mind goes to growth hormone, right? And that's not wrong. You know, you want to associate growth hormone with growing those cells. But thyroxine is important for making the cells in your body grow and develop. I want to emphasize that word, develop. So proper development of your body starts the day that you were conceived, That's way before the day that you're born. But throughout growth in utero and growth in childhood, you've got to have enough thyroxine to make those cells and tissues develop. Like I said, I want to avoid that word grow because it makes your mind go elsewhere. So this is such an important hormone that babies are tested for thyroxine levels the day they're born. You may not realize that when a baby's born, they take them and they poke them and prod them quite a bit. And one of the things they test for is just a little dose of blood gives them thyroxine levels. If babies are born with low thyroxine levels, they want to start treatment right then. They don't want to wait until the kid grows up because we're going to lose valuable time there. And people who do not have enough thyroxine from the day of birth forward, they can develop a condition called congenital hypothyroidism. Literally, what does congenital mean? At birth, yeah. So if a person has too little thyroid hormone or thyroxine made, then they have this condition. It actually causes dwarfism, a form of dwarfism. This has nothing to do with growth hormone, but this is a different issue due to the lack of thyroxine. So keep in mind, thyroxine promotes normal growth and development of those cells. Without it, those bodies just don't grow properly. So you'll notice this person here, not very tall, a distinctive look to the face. And then if you look at this picture, you'll notice on the far left, that person there is actually developing with cretinism, not enough thyroid hormone. If they can catch this early enough during childhood, then they can prevent the dwarfism that ensues with this problem. Another sad effect of this condition is mental retardation. So if the brain doesn't have enough thyroid hormone, it's not going to develop properly either. So that's why it's so critical to catch this condition early on, not only to promote the proper growth and development of the cells and tissues, but to make the nervous system develop properly. All right, sex hormones are also important. At what period of life do they kick on and start being produced?
Puberty.
Yeah, so, you know, 12, 13, 14, we start seeing these hormones really start to kick on. We start to see estrogen levels rise in females and testosterone levels rise in males. We do know that during puberty, that growth plate tends to grow rather quickly. And once it grows and has its last hurrah of growth, that ossification line where osteoblast reside is going to catch up. And we know that bone growth will certainly end by the time puberty is done. So we know that puberty is one time that we see sex hormones be rather important for bone growth. But we know also for women later in life that estrogen level loss through the death of those ovary tissues causes bone growth to also change in the way it's structured. So later in life, we do see things like osteoporosis develop from a lack of these hormones. All right, let's talk about exercise for just a moment. On the far left, you'll notice two pictures of bone tissue. Which one do you think has been subjected to exercise?
A.
A, yeah, that top one. What makes you think it's been subjected?
Denser.
Denser, yeah, it's a denser type of bone, and there's less air spaces in there. This bottom picture is probably bone that hasn't been exercised. If you don't exercise it, just like muscle tissue, then there's less calcium deposited to that bone tissue. So, you know, if you've got an older person, 60s, 70s, 80s, and they're feeling weak, it's not just muscle tissue that's affected from lack of exercise. We also understand that bone tissue loses density as you don't exercise. It puts stress on those bones. All right, so questions down below for you. How do bones respond to stress, like exercise? They become denser and they strengthen. Good. They become denser and they strengthen. Next question there says, why is exercise necessary? And of course, this means for bones. Well, exercise helps promote calcium deposits to the bone. Exercise promotes calcium deposits. Okay, exercise promotes calcium deposits to the bone. And bones that are not stressed, like B picture here below, what happens to those bones? Yeah, they're weaker, they're less dense. Okay, so bones that are not stressed become weaker, they're less dense. So interesting thing here to think about, if you've got a 70-year-old person who's experiencing some bone loss, one prescription may be to lift weights. And we know that lifting weights is a way to put stress on the bones. It strengthens muscles, which in turn strengthens bone, and that can cause bones to become denser, stronger, and have more calcium deposited there. So, you know, the thought of lifting heavy stuff for an old person, you know, conjures up ideas of broken bones or other issues. But in fact, if it's done in the right way where we build up strength, then we can actually reduce the possibility of fractures and whatnot in those bones. So, you know, not cardio necessarily, but weightlifting for older adults can help strengthen those bones. Last condition here to talk about is osteoporosis. This causes bone loss, same way that osteomalacia would, but there's an underlying different reason for this. This just is due to the porosity of bone becoming, you know, weaker, and it oftentimes has to do with hormone level changes, especially in older adults that are female. Okay, so on your worksheet down there, the cause of osteoporosis tends to be hormone loss in older age. Hormone loss in older age, especially estrogen. All right, and who tends to be most affected by osteoporosis? Yeah, women especially. Those with a thinner frame and those with a Caucasian or Asian background tend to be more affected. So ladies, if you carry a little more weight on your body, then that reduces the risk of osteoporosis, because the more weight we carry, the more those bones have to be able to manage the body's weight. So in this case, you know, it's one condition where having a little extra flesh is not a bad thing. So women can actually fracture their bones in their spine. They can lose several inches of body mass or of spinal mass off of those that vertebral column back there. So. And here you can see again, just simply having osteoporosis means the bone becomes more porous, and with the loss of porosity, a loss of that structure there, then we tend to see bones fracture more easily.
My grand lost 6 inches.
Mine did too, yeah.
Or 60s too.
And then start getting bent, yeah.
Microfractures in the cervical.
You just start crushing them down. Yeah, that's gotta be painful. So yeah, this is what happens. These are compression fractures. So the body of the vertebrae actually becomes compressed when there's loss of structure there. And you're right, you know, 5-6 inches is not unheard of for somebody with this osteoporosis condition. So speaking of fractures, why don't we turn over to page 71 and we'll talk about some fracture issues there. So when bones are fractured, the worst case scenario is probably an open fracture, and that's one where the bone pokes through the skin. Because when the bone pokes through the skin, that bone is now exposed to the environment. And what can happen to the bone? Infection, yeah. And so we definitely don't want to have that happening. Bone infection is called osteomyelitis. And these white spots on the bone tissue here are actually infection in the bone. This is bad news, right? Because what do bones make in their marrow?
Blood cells.
And there's a great blood supply here. So what looks like it may start out as a localized problem may in fact spread and become a systemic issue. The person may develop sepsis, which is a body-wide infection. So that's why having, you know, osteomyelitis set in for a bone that's been fractured is certainly something we want to watch for. In this condition here, you can see that even if the bone doesn't poke through the skin, if there's been damage to the tissues around it that allow infection to get into that bone, that can cause the surrounding tissues to become infected. And when any tissue becomes infected, we oftentimes see inflammation. What are those four cardinal signs for inflammation? That's it, good. Red, hot, swelling, and pain. And so unfortunately, that can lead to other conditions like compartment syndrome. I mean, I'll show you a picture of that in just a moment. All I can think of is, 100 years ago, before there were antibiotics, if you had a broken bone, my gosh, that could have been a death sentence. Without antibiotics, and the bone tissue that's been infected and surrounding tissues, all we need is for that to run systemically, and then we've got game over. So not a very pain-free way to go, I might add. If you happen to have a closed fracture, then that may be one where the bone does not penetrate through the skin. That also leads me to the next concept, open reduction and closed reduction. If you happen to have open reduction, you'll notice that the bone is put back together with pins, like you see here, and that usually involves surgical placement of those pins. So the bone is actually open to the environment for those pins to be placed there. If there's no surgery required, then we may see something like this picture here, just manually setting the bones back in place using closed reduction. That would not be very comfortable because it may involve refracturing the bones. Bones are going to heal really quickly. The minute you break them, they're going to start automatically rehealing themselves. So let's walk through the process of bone healing. The moment you break a bone, a blood clot forms, and that's called a hematoma. And immediately, we start seeing cells migrate into the area. And what's going to happen is we've got cartilage cells reform around that broken bone. Cartilage is actually the basis for bone production. So we have cartilage cells migrate in first. And we call this area a fibrocartilage callus. So what do you know about cartilage and its strength? It's stretchy, it's flexible. Yeah, this is not what you want to have permanently heal your bone, right? So we've got cartilage that moves in first, but this is certainly not the end game. The next stage is to have osteoblast move in. What do they do for that area?
Build bone,
right. And then finally, we need to remodel that bone. So what kind of bone-destroying cells migrate in? Osteoclast. And if we were to look at an x-ray, you may actually see a faint line across where bones have been broken, and that's because it's not going to ever re-heal back exactly like it was before. But those clasts should remodel and try to do as much as they can to refinish that bone in its proper shape. Just wanted to mention to you some common types of bone fractures. Young bone may experience what's called a green stick fracture. Just like a bush that has green branches, if you try to break a branch off of a fresh growth of a bush or a tree, you can't break it cleanly. You may have a partial break, and that's what we call a green stick fracture. So if you have a green stick fracture, that probably indicates you've got an impartial break or indicates that you're looking at a child. We just talked about compression fractures. What disorder leads to these?
Osteoporosis,
right. This is a depression fracture. It looks like a ball or some type of object might have hit this skull. But a depression fracture literally does, as the name implies, it depresses a piece of that bone tissue. Another depression fracture there on the skull. Spiral fractures can be two things. They can be twisting an arm or a leg, or they can be a case where somebody's being abused and a person is trying to wrench their arm or leg away from somebody who's holding on to them. So it literally creates a spiral fracture like you see right here through the tibia, through that bone. So if physicians or radiology people see a spiral fracture, then they may question, is this something going on at home? Or they may simply say, you know, is this a sports injury? So, you know, twisting an arm or a leg is going to produce a spiral fracture. And boy, oh boy, this is not the one you want here. A comminuted fracture is a multiple bone fracture. It's basically a shattered bone. This is going to probably involve some pins to put back this mess together. So comminuted fractures are multiple fractures in a bone. And when I was mentioning a few minutes ago about having inflammation of bone tissue, the surrounding tissue may in fact be damaged as well. And unfortunately, this can create a condition that we call compartment syndrome. You know, we talked earlier about, you know, loose areolar and dense types of tissues that surround and bind and package tissues. Well, if you have inflammation, you have swelling. And if that tissue is surrounded by a dense or a packaging type of tissue, then the swelling is contained to that compartment, and thus ensues compartment syndrome. Compartment syndrome can be really bad because the tissues surrounded by those tissues may not have anywhere to go, so they can't push beyond that compartment. Unfortunately, this may involve having to cut into a tissue to allow the tissue to drain. So, you know, there have been cases where people have had like a broken tibia, for instance, and they've had to slice the leg open to allow the tissues to expand and swell until the inflammation goes away. So, you know, imagine back in the day, they weren't quite so aware of bacteria and infection. If they did something like a slice through a tissue to create reduced stress and pressure in that area, that might have just introduced bacteria, and then now you've got a secondary problem. So, just wanted to mention this one, not a comfortable side effect of having a broken bone. All right, so that should take us through page 71. How about questions on that page? I do want to mention that our test on Thursday will stop with page 71. And since we have a few minutes, I would like to cover what I can of Chapter 8, and then I'm going to open the floor to you for questions. All right, so Chapter 8 is just a really short one. It is a little bit about joints. Have you covered this in lab already?
No.
Not yet, okay. So we'll be just a tad bit ahead of what y'all are doing in lab. So the word articulation means joints, and I don't mean smoky bars, I mean those joints in your body that bones or cartilage come together. So when we're talking about joints, I want to erase the thought of elbows and knees from your mind and add to that other kinds of areas where bones and cartilage come together. So sometimes joints are immovable, sometimes they're very freely movable. And when we talk about their mobility, we're actually talking about a functional classification. Hey, catch this great clue. Functional is sad. Okay, synarthrosis, amphiarthrosis, diarthrosis are the ways that we describe our functional joint classifications. So let me mention that the suffix there, arthrosis, means joint, or condition of the joint, to be technical, and the prefix tells you the degree of mobility. That prefix syn or sim means what?
Together.
So that's not a movable joint. Synarthroses are immovable joints, no mobility in those types of joints. Amphi means on both sides. Those have a little bit of flexibility, some more than others. But if you want the greatest degree of flexibility in a joint, you're looking at what's called a diarthrosis. So in the order that they're listed, synarthrosis is least movable, amphiarthrosis is somewhat movable, and diarthrosis is freely movable. Let's also talk about how we classify joints structurally. We know that joints can be made up of collagen fibers, and if they are, that's what we call a fibrous joint. Some joints are made up of cartilage, and so those are called cartilaginous joints. And some joints are very fancy and have a synovial membrane, and that synovial membrane produces synovial fluid. What does synovial fluid do for the joint? Lubricates, right. So the synovial joints are actually the most complicated in terms of structure, and they're going to be found only in those freely movable joints. Okay, so I want to show you a little trick here. Synarthrosis joints can be fibrous. Synarthrosis joints can be cartilage. Okay? Amphiarthroses are somewhat movable. You know, most of those are going to be cartilaginous. There's a few that are fibrous. And then diarthroses joints, they're all synovial. So it's hard to say it's one for one across the thing here, but you can at least say that diarthroses joints, they're always going to be synovial. Okay, so let me do that one more time. Synarthroses are not movable. They can be fibrous. They can be cartilage. Amphiarthroses are somewhat movable. They are mostly cartilaginous. They can be fibrous, so they're, again, both of those. But the last one, diarthroses, they're only synovial. Okay. So let's talk about synarthritic joints. These are joints that are not movable. And they may be fibrous in nature, or they may be cartilaginous in nature. So when we talk about fibrous cartilage or fibrous synarthritic joints, we're actually talking about your skull sutures. And we're talking about your teeth joints. And when we get through this, you're going to say, oh my gosh, what did we just talk about? So when you're studying this for lecture test 3, this is not lecture test 2, thank goodness, right? Lecture test 3, flashcard this stuff. And then if you're doing this for a lab test, I would flashcard it, make those words stick, because you're going to go syn, sim, what after you leave here. After we get through two more words, your brain's going to be floating in syn and sim arthroses words. Okay, so let me show you a picture of the skull, of course. We never think about our skull sutures moving, and that is because they don't move. Functionally, they can be one of three things: synarthrosis, amphiarthrosis, or diarthrosis. Because they are not movable, how should we categorize them? Syn. Yep, they are not movable. Teeth joints technically are not movable. We know that braces and, you know, getting teeth knocked out can do otherwise, but they are not meant to be movable either. And because they're attached to gums, we call teeth joints gomphosis. So use that trick to help you. A teeth joint is called a gomphosis. So let me make this go back and make this clearer. When you're talking about functionality, your skull doesn't move, your teeth don't move. They are synarthrosis joints. When we're talking about what they're made of, or, you know, their specific details, they're both fibrous in nature. That is a structural description, okay? So functionally, skull sutures and teeth are synarthroses. Structurally, we want to know what they're made of, and they're fibrous. That means there's collagen fibers that hold your skull sutures together, and your teeth and your mandible and maxilla. Way back when you were a baby, you probably had soft spots on your head, and those were collagen fibers and sheets of membrane that held together those skull bones. But of course, as you develop and grow, those bones grow and knit into each other and make those sutures. Okay. Asynchondrosis is another name for your epiphyseal plate. I know your brain now is just done. It's shut off, right? So syn means together. What does con, C-H-O-N-D, tell you? Cartilage, yeah. Syn is together, con is cartilage. Okay, so let me back up a step. Functionally, we are talking about a syn arthrosis joint, not movable, okay? Structurally, your epiphyseal plates are called synchondrosis. And they're not meant to be movable, they're not meant to be flexible. But nonetheless, that layer of cartilage that divides the epiphysis from your diaphysis, that actually creates a joint because it's where two or more skeletal elements come together. So it is not meant to be movable. I mean, gosh, no one wants their epiphyseal plates to bend and give, but nonetheless, it is classified as a joint. I know your brain is done at this point, right? Okay. And so in this picture, you can see the epiphyseal plate because it's still cartilage. Once it becomes bone, it looks like a white line through the ends of those long bones. So what does amphiarthrosis tell us about the degree of flexibility? Slightly movable, good. And is amphiarthrosis a functional or a structural name? It's functional, right? It's how movable that joint is. These slightly movable joints may contain cartilage, and they may be called symphysis joints, or they may be fibrous in nature, which means they're built from collagen. And so those are called syndesmosis. I can't emphasize here how important it is to translate the words. Those words that you're learning in lab can greatly help you here. Where do you find a symphysis on your body?
Pubis.
Yeah, so right here between the two pubic bones, there is a pubic symphysis. It is a band of cartilage, and that's all it is holding together those two pubic bones. This is a most important feature for a pregnant female. Guys never have to worry about this thing. What happens to that pubic symphysis in females who are pregnant? It opens up, it relaxes, right? There is a hormone called relaxin that tells that joint to relax, and those pubis bones kind of relax apart a little bit. Later in pregnancy, this is partly why females have a pregnancy waddle, because of the joints they're having spread apart. After pregnancy, the relaxin is no longer made, so the joint should go back together, and the pregnancy waddle should be gone. Should be, right? Okay, so these are cartilaginous, they're a little bit movable. They're only, of course, of interest for a pregnant female, really no one else. This is another symphysis joint, the joint in your back. So it is literally bone, cartilage, that creates a joint that's somewhat movable. You know, I think you can bend quite a bit with your back, you know, compared to other slightly movable joints, but nonetheless, it is amphiarthrosis in functional nature. It is a symphysis joint when we talk about its structure. This is another amphiarthrosis joint, but this time we're looking at bones like tibia and fibula, or even ulna and radius. Those places where you've got two long bones sitting side by side, there are bands of tendons and ligaments that anchor them together and anchor your muscles to them. We do not want those bones separating, especially in your leg. Imagine if these two bones were to separate, there'd be nothing supporting that lower leg portion. So we have ligaments and tendons binding all of these areas together. That forms what we call a syndesmosis. Desmo means band. Okay, and that means band as in ligament or tendon. This is the easy category. Diarthroses is a category of the functional classification, and diarthroses are freely movable. So what does the word synovial tell you?
Lubrication,
yeah. It's the way the joint is structured. There's membrane there. There's fluid there. And you're right, it's all about lubricating that joint. And in this picture, you can see there's a good bit of space between those two bones that articulate together. And that fluid has to be just right in there in order for the bones to articulate. If it's like an engine and your oil runs out, your engine burns up, right? If you have too little synovial fluid in that joint, what happens to the bones? They grind, they rub, and then you can end up with what's called osteoarthritis when they deteriorate each other's endings. So too little synovial fluid's bad, just as much as too much can be bad. If you have too much fluid in the joint, it can promote swelling and a condition that we call bursitis. That also can be very uncomfortable and painful. So let's talk about the parts of a typical synovial joint. You'll notice that there's cartilage covering the ends of the long bones. That's so that they don't rub and grind into each other. There's fluid there. We know that fluid is all about reducing friction, lubricating those joints. There are fat pockets. In fact, there's a fat pocket behind your knee that you probably don't even know is back there, but it's again about lubricating and cushioning the joint. And then there's ligaments and tendons that help to stabilize a joint. They're not shown in this picture here, but they are in this one. Specifically, what does a ligament bind a bone to? Another bone, good. So that blank on your worksheet, ligaments anchor bone to bone. Tendons, ankle muscle to bone. Ligaments anchor bone to bone. Tendons anchor muscle to bone. Both, do you recall, are made up of dense what? Dense regular, yeah. Both are dense regular connective tissue. I had a student many years ago, she had a trick for remembering these because it's easy to flip-flop what tendons and ligaments bind. And she said, Larry buys books, LBB, ligaments, bone to bone. So maybe that'll work to help keep that to stick for you. Larry buys books, ligaments, bone to bone. In fact, I had to say it before I told you what the blank was. Not in either of these pictures, but I did put one in your course pack. These little sacs of synovial fluid that surrounds your joint are called bursa sacs, and they're like little pockets of synovial membrane that produce synovial fluid. So think of them as like little water balloons around your joints, and it is their job to help provide like the cushioning for those bones as they articulate together. And like I mentioned earlier, if those bursa sacs become inflamed, they'll swell, they may over-secrete or hyper-secrete fluids, and then we see a swelling or a redness in that joint that can be very painful. In those cases, we may in fact have to extract out and pull out that fluid or give a steroid to help reduce inflammation in those joints. Elbows are bad for having bursitis, so are shoulders and knees, so any inflammation in those joints can be very painful and uncomfortable. So I just wanted to show you, this is what arthritis is. Arthritis is inflammation of a joint. Rheumatoid is an immune condition that causes the body to attack the joint tissues. Can cause deformities in the hands and feet. It can also affect other body parts like the organs, like heart for instance. This is a particular type of arthritis called gout. And it happens to be more common in men than in women, and it results from a buildup of a type of acid in the bloodstream. Those acid crystals that build up in the bloodstream can highly affect these particular joints like the toes, like you can see here, and there are medications that they can give to help reduce the uric acid or uremic acid crystals in those joints. These are common gout locations. Diet changes can also reduce the incidence of gout in men. So reducing meat and seafood from the diet can actually reduce the incidence of gout.
Beer has insurance too.
Beer, yeah, so.
Darn.
Yeah, and avoid the fun stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
But interesting, not that I'm in here advertising to take homeopathic methods to cure your diseases, but mustard has turmeric in it, and that is one way to help reduce the effects of gout. So not all the time is medicine necessary if you are willing to try out something like a homeopathic medicine. Since we're kind of pushing out of time here, why don't I save page 74 for not this Thursday, but next Tuesday's class period, and that will actually finish up chapter 8 for us. And I'd like to open the floor to you all for questions for the upcoming test. So the test, just to make sure we're all on the same page, in your course pack, we'll start on page 43, and the last page will be 71. So 43 to 71 is test 2 material. 43 to 71. It just says chapters 4, 5, and 6 on there, but roughly those are the pages it corresponds to.
So that's under that, it'll be the same stuff as in the...
Yeah, that's right. So anything that talks about exam 2 is going to be those pages. Yeah. I just want to mention, while you're flipping back at your notes, there are no tissue pictures on this test. No tissue pictures. I know you've had your run through those. What we will do is I may say to you, I've got a tissue that's intercalated disc, striations, voluntary contractions. You would say that's, cardiac muscle tissue. I may describe to you a type of tissue that has multiple layers, an apical surface, keratinocytes, melanocytes. This sounds like epithelial tissue, yeah. I may say to you, tendons and ligaments are made up of this tissue type. Dense regular, yeah, that's a connective tissue. I may talk to you about neurons, neuroglia, conducting nerve impulses. You would say that sounds like
nervous
tissue, right. So you're looking more at structure, functions, locations. I would not look at your pictures at all, but those other things, structure, function, location would be my primary study point. What can I help you with? Anything from chapter 4?
You want to tell us that?
Are we going to have review questions from other chapters as well?
There will be 3 review questions, if I remember correctly, and it's from those commonly missed questions from test 1.
Okay.
Just like review questions?
Yeah, like I've got Merkel cells written down, but I didn't write, except
the
epithelial.
Yeah, let's look at those. Okay, so if we talk about some skin stuff, if you want to follow along with me, we can look at page 54. So in terms of names of cells here, let's hit this and then we'll turn over a few pages and look at something else. Keratinocytes in the epidermis make keratin. Also in the epidermis, we have melanocytes that produce melanin. And this one's one that's hard to remember. It's a Langerhans cell that produces, it's actually a type of white blood cell that's on patrol in your epidermis. So those are 3 cell names to keep track of for the epidermis on page 54. And then if you flip with me over a few pages to 60, let's talk about some more related cells in the epidermis. Okay, so on page 60, there are several types of cells there that respond to changes in your body. First one there, middle of the page, is a tactile receptor. It's called a Merkel disc or a Meissner corpuscle. And the thing to know about it is that this type of receptor in your skin is a set of nerves, and they're structured in a way to pick up on fine touch and vibrations or pressure in the skin. Not vibrations, I shouldn't remove that one, but you'll notice the shape of it there. If it's pushed down or depressed, then you feel a sense of touch or pressure on your skin. Now, if you're talking about deep pressure, that's a different kind of receptor altogether. That's this one here that looks kind of like an onion. It's a lamellated receptor. And Ruffini corpuscles, kind of have a tree-like appearance here, and they're the ones that are picking up on tearing or stretching of the skin surface. So if you're, you know, trying to avoid having your skin rip, which is a dangerous thing for the way skin grows, these Ruffini corpuscles happen to pick up on skin stretch or skin potentially about to tear. In terms of cells in the skin that do a job, those five or six would probably cover it. How about other stuff with skin you'd like to hit? Wound healing. For skin or just any tissue? Okay. All right, so wound healing in your course pack is actually over a page. Okay, that's in the top of 61. This process of healing your skin is actually the way that most tissues heal. We start off with inflammation, which is bleeding. You know, if you've got bleeding, that is followed by redness, swelling, heat, those four cardinal signs that we expect to see with inflammation. Bleeding is actually a benefit because it can flush out microbes from the area, and it also helps to bring in stage two, which is the migratory phase. During the migratory phase, we've already got a scab that's been put in place, but now we start seeing white blood cells move into the area. And what is their job once they're there?
Fight bacteria.
Yeah, fight bacteria, eat bacteria. They're also going to eat and clean up the place. So any dead tissue or dead cells here will be eaten and destroyed by those white blood cells that are eating microbes. Once we start cleaning up the place, new cells can grow back and new fibers can reemerge. This is called a proliferatory phase. And so we see the new fibroblast in this area growing back fibers. And unfortunately, if your skin does not heal correctly, that's all we're left with are fibers. And that fibrous tissue that's left behind is called scar tissue. Nobody wants scar tissue because it doesn't have sensations or feelings. It may not have glands, so it doesn't reduce heat problems like we would normally expect to see. So we hope that healing doesn't stop here with scar tissue. We hope that normal tissues return to this area as the skin tends to finish off the reparation process. But in some cases, we do know that scar tissue is all that's left behind. So the maturation phase may take some time, you know, depending on how badly that skin has been damaged, and hopefully we'll move past that scar tissue in that maturation phase. All right, so that actually kind of covers both tissue repair from Chapter 4 and tissue repair from Chapter 5. All right, how about other questions? I know you guys have a lab quiz today. If you get home and have some questions, feel free to email me. Come by and see me. I'm down in 5316, end of this hallway. And if not, I will see you on Thursday around 9:30 then.